This podcast is brought to you in part by Contact My Politician, a free, fast way to find your local and national politicians and to keep them accountable. Click on their banner at our website, michaelmedved.com.
And now, your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great day and a great week when we are about to give thanks for all of the many, many blessings that America has conferred upon us. And in that context, it seems to me worthwhile to take a particular look at a stunning new book by Kevin Williamson, who's been on this show before. Kevin Williamson is the roving correspondent for National Review. And he is the author, most recently, of Big White Ghetto, Dead Broke, Stone Cold Stupid, and High on Rage in the Dank, Woolly Wilds of the Real America. He has also written a terrific piece that I think is necessary reading, and we will also post it at our website at michaelmedved.com, called The Dumbest Coup. Which is a reflection on part of the attempts to overturn this particular election. Kevin, great to speak to you again. And first of all, the pieces that you collect in Big White Ghetto all have to do with your travels, your personal experience in a great big chunk of America, which you say is actually 98.5% white, and if it weren't, it would be called a reservation. Why?
Well, because it has a lot of the same pathologies, things like Indian reservations or city ghettos and things like that. In this case, I'm talking about long-term persistent intergenerational poverty, high levels of alcohol abuse, drug addiction, lots of welfare dependency, lots of joblessness, lots of the pathologies that go along with those things.
And what you're talking about is a chunk of the country, as you explain, towns and villages stretching from northern Mississippi to southern New York, what people used to refer to all the time as Appalachia. Is there more?
Yeah, a big part of the book is about Appalachia, although some of it's about, you know, everything from West Texas to Southern California to parts of Philadelphia and Chicago that I've also spent some time writing about and reporting about that have problems that are related to what we see in those areas. And there's some interesting, you know, takeaways from that, because one of the things you really learn if you spend a lot of time writing about this sort of thing is that poverty in rural America is not very much like poverty in urban America. It just sort of manifests itself in different ways. So even though Appalachia has really high rates of drug abuse and welfare dependency and poverty, it's got a relatively low crime rate. And the violent crime rate's about half of the national average. It also has relatively high levels of marriage. So a lot of things we tell ourselves, you know, whether it's poverty causes crime, or if you get married and don't have children out of wedlock, you won't end up poor, just aren't true, and they fly in the face of the evidence that we actually see in that part of the country.
Okay, in terms of that part of the country, one of the things you focus on is not only the poverty, but the drug abuse. That kind of crime is extremely widespread. Has it gotten better? Because one of the things that is also striking in your book, and the book again is called Big White Ghetto, is this is Trump country. You were talking about Owsley County in Kentucky, where President Trump, I believe, got over 80% of the vote. Have things improved over the last 4 years in what you call the Big White Ghetto?
Yeah, there have been some improvements. So, I mean, across the country, and this includes Appalachia, the unemployment rate has gone down some, wages have gone up some. So that's really very helpful to people who are working and looking for work. As I often say, we talk a lot about the working class, but the real problem in this country, the people who have the longest-term problems, are the non-working classes, people who have long-term unemployment either in their own lives or in their community. So life has been, you know, reasonably good for a lot of working Americans, although obviously the epidemic has upset a lot of that. I suspect we'll bounce back from that pretty quickly. But the problems have more to do with, you know, people who've been out of work not only their whole lives, but for generations, where they don't have anyone in their family who's really earned a steady income for years and years. That ends up being a very different sort of picture. And that's one of the reasons why I've written so much about these places that have concentrated poverty, because the experience of being poor in a poor place is really quite different from the experience of being poor in a place that isn't poor. You know, I grew up relatively poor, but I grew up in a college town, so most of my friends' parents were college professors and professionals and things like that. So there's some social capital there you can kind of borrow and drift on. But when you grow up in a place, you know, 6,500 people and you know, 70% of the people there are on some kind of welfare and lots of unemployment, you don't have the same kind of social capital that you can tap. And it really cruelly limits, I think, young people's imaginations about what they can achieve with their own lives and what they can do.
Is there something that could be done about it by political leaders in the federal level?
Not really. There are things that can be done for individuals. One of the things that I've talked about is repackaging a certain amount of our unemployment benefits as relocation benefits, because it can be very hard for people to move to where there's work when they've lost a job themselves and they don't have the money to put a deposit on a new apartment and rent the truck and all that kind of stuff. It can be very difficult, as I know, because I've done it myself a few times over the years. But in terms of turning things around for these largely isolated rural communities, no, there's probably not. Even if you moved some big business there, you'd probably have to bring in most of the employees because the people who live there don't have the skills or the education to fill the jobs of the sort that would change really a community like that.
One of the things you write about in the book that I noted is how much the places that you are writing about across the country are impacted just by the people with the greatest enterprise and the greatest energy and the greatest skills leaving. They get the heck out of Dodge.
And this can
even involve beautiful countryside, but they leave.
Yeah, there's some really lovely places out there that would be great places to live if you work from home. You don't need to be close to a Walmart or something. Alsea County, which we can go to in the book, is close to an hour's drive from the nearest Walmart. It's in half an hour to the nearest FedEx Dropbox. You know, it's not real Amazon Prime type country. Yeah, I think a lot of people who've grown up in small towns, particularly in rural areas, have seen this, where basically everyone with any education or hope of getting an education or much energy or sense of enterprise or entrepreneurship leaves, and they leave pretty young, and they don't come back. And the people who are left behind really are people who are left behind in a more profound sense, people who've been left behind not just by the people who left, but by a society that in many ways has moved on and is looking for new things that they don't really have the ability to offer.
So what would be your advice to, say, a local leader in like Boonesville, Kentucky, which you write about? What should you do to try to reinvigorate these places that are in very bad shape, as you make clear in very colorful and eloquent language?
Yeah, well, I don't really think that a lot of them can be. I mean, we've seen cities bounce back, you know, from losing big industries. Los Angeles, once upon a time, was a big manufacturing city. Before, it was a big entertainment city. Cities can weather changes in the economy better, I think, than rural areas can. You know, Detroit's a good example of how not to do it, where a lot of places have lost big industrial employers the way Detroit did with the automobile industry, but they find other things that bounce back. Philadelphia is a pretty good example of that. It's not maybe the best governed city in the country by any stretch of the imagination, but it's figured out a way to thrive after the decline of local manufacturing, but some places don't. So what local governments can really do, the most they can do, is to do their jobs, to do things that they're supposed to do and do them right, have decent schools, have roads that work, have infrastructure that's properly maintained and intelligently invested in.
And you also mentioned libraries. Libraries can be a really important local resource in places where there are no bookstores. Kevin D. Williamson, roving correspondent for National Review, his new book, Big White Ghetto, Dead Broke, Stone Cold Stupid, and High on Rage and the Dank Woolly Wilds of the Real America. A fascinating and important read coming back on The Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Show, with Thanksgiving coming up this week, it's a great time to take advantage of our big holiday sale, which has just begun at the Medved History Store. The biggest feature at the Medved History Store, the entire Medved History Store library. It comes on a terrific thumb drive. It's more than 100 hours, close to 120 hours of programming about the history of this country. It's like a full year's course on the deep history of the United States, including questions about divine providence, divine intervention, the true story of the 4th of July, a true story of the Thanksgiving holiday, and much, much more. And it's all 60% off right now, the lowest price we've ever offered for the full Medved History Store library. Go to michaelmedved.com. You can see the banner for the sale, and it's also 25% off everything else. In other words, the full library gives you everything. But if you want to get just a separate programming, 25% off that. Go to michaelmedved.com and click on the banner for the holiday sale at Medved History Store. There's a major city in America, and Kevin D. Williamson was talking about some of the differences between urban poverty in ghettos and big cities and some of the rural poverty or small town poverty that he was writing about in his book, Big White Ghetto. Well, this is America's second largest city, and they made some history over the weekend. A headline in the Los Angeles Times, LA hits 300 homicides for the first time in a decade. Amid a rash of weekend gun violence, writes Kevin Rector, Los Angeles early Sunday morning reached a bloody benchmark not seen in a decade, 300 homicides. The milestone comes amid growing concerns about spikes in violence this year, not just in Los Angeles, but also big cities across the country. From Saturday into Sunday morning, there were four killings, among many other shootings, the LAPD said. Much of the violence occurred in South LA. One victim was a 17-year-old boy riding a bicycle. Another, a 50-year-old homeless man. A 20-year-old man was killed, as was another 41-year-old woman. In past decades, Los Angeles experienced far more violence, with more than 1,000 homicides in some peaks in the years of the 1980s and 1990s. The city, however, was able to successfully cut those homicides, and it hasn't gone above 300 killings since 2009. It's 11 years ago. Now, with a surge in homicides happening in other cities across the country, too, Los Angeles has seen a 25% increase in killings over the last year, hitting the 300 mark with more than a month still left in 2020. Shootings are up more than 32%. Okay, this is crazy. Wouldn't you think, with a pandemic going on, with lockdowns, with fewer large gatherings being permitted, with bars being closed, wouldn't you think that a lockdown would produce fewer killings, not more? And a 25% increase in homicides is just, it's just crazy. Now, could part of this have to do with all of the anti-police protests, and they don't even mention it in the Los Angeles Times. But the efforts by Mayor Garcetti and the city council in LA to cut police budgets, if you pull back policing, you get more crime. This is not rocket science. It's not complicated. But if you're going to make war on police departments, it'll lead to war in the streets. Official figures in the LAPD's data-driven CompStat unit stood at 299 homicides for the year Sunday morning. Although the latest violence will push up the figure higher once final confirmations are made, including with the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office. And they list the stories here, and they're just all so awful. It's all so horrible. Around 6 p.m. Saturday, two 30-year-old men were shot by four people who rolled past in a vehicle in the 1200 block of Innis Avenue near Dodger Stadium, world champion Los Angeles Dodgers. Both were transported to a hospital. Just before 7 a.m. Sunday morning, a 19-year-old man was found suffering from a gunshot wound in the sidewalk in the 4,500 block of Martin Luther King Boulevard. The man was uncooperative with police, who have no suspect information. Okay, can I say that for people whose immediate response is new gun laws, how about enforcing the very strict gun laws that already exist in Los Angeles? The problem here is gangs. And the idea for a need for a national effort focused on more resources for police officers and for a very serious nationwide war on gangs. Okay, we're not talking about a war on drugs, though that's part of it. And of course, many gangs exist to peddle drugs. But there has to be something that can bring us back down. There's no reason that to believe that things have changed so much for the worse in the last 10 years that we should be up at 300 homicides in L.A., for the first time in a decade. There's another story from another part of the country that actually is considerably more encouraging. And it involves Portland, Oregon. Headline, workers begin cleaning Portland's Laurelhurst Park. Now, why would Laurelhurst Park need this major attention and attract so much attention here? Because what they're cleaning is a settlement. Or at least you could describe it as that. We will get to that story and more coming up on The MedVet Show.
Your outlet for outrage.
It's outrageous what's going on out here.
It's the Michael Medved Show.
It's a tremendous, tremendous thing, and I'm telling you, it's going to explode.
The Michael Medved Show.
Medved Show, you don't hear so much about Japan because they're an ally, not an adversary like China. But as you are very well aware, some of the greatest companies in the world are Japanese companies. And one of those big Japanese companies, Oryx, has just pumped some $60 million into a investment in our crowd. And even if you don't have $60 million, even if you don't have $1 million, you can still be part of the exciting investments through the Jerusalem-based Our Crowd. Now, a lot of this is Israeli high tech, which has done spectacularly well recently. But they also invest in companies in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, around the world, startups that can make a very, very big difference for you and for your life. Participate in this group funding effort for some of the most exciting high-tech startups in the world. Check it out. You can get information, a free newsletter, and in-depth information about some of these exciting opportunities sent directly to you if you just go to find the Our Crowd banner at our website at michaelmedved.com. Okay, this is not exactly high-tech, but it does represent progress, I think. We have a Michael Medved homeless solidarity moment.
Another homeless solidarity moment from your cultural crusader.
Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. I don't like work, and work don't like me. And that is the reason I am so hungry. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Okay, this from Oregon and a report for the Oregonian by Dave Killen, who says workers and volunteers began sweeping a long-established homeless encampment alongside Southeast Portland's Laurelhurst Park on Thursday. A small crew of workers in red rapid response BioClean jackets could be seen loading items into a truck Thursday morning. Volunteers were also on hand to help. A stretch of sidewalk along Southeast Oak Street that abuts the park had been home to a sprawling encampment with more than 100 people estimated to be living there. Just think about that for a moment. 100 people has to be at, what, 50 tents more? 40? Some residents of the wealthy Eastside neighborhood grew increasingly incensed about its months-long presence and demanded action by the city. But of course, it took months for the city to remove 100 people camping in the park. The city of Portland posted a notice to the park earlier this month saying it planned to sweep the camp. That prompted protesters, of course, to gather at the park last week, decrying the city's attempt to displace those living there. But no previously rumored sweeps materialized. A rapid response BioClean office in Southeast Portland was later vandalized, which police and city officials blamed on some of the demonstrators. I think the number of folks on the ground supporting residents in terms of feeding and things like that has dwindled because of COVID worry, said one spokesperson for the encampment. So that is a possible reason that the sweep could have happened. The Laurelhurst sweep has been one of the city's most high-profile and controversial in months. Portland completely halted campsite removals at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, citing guidance from the Centers for Disease Control. I don't understand how permitting encampments in public parks helps discourage the spread of COVID. You think all these people living in their tents and sleeping on the ground and often out of their minds with substance abuse and other things, you think they're all wearing masks, careful with social distancing? They resumed again in a limited capacity at the end of July, city officials said. That is, trying to clear out some of the homeless encampments. Heather Hafer, a spokesperson for Portland's Homelessness and Urban Camping Impact Reduction Program, urban camping? Is that a euphemism or what? Said the city currently clears out about 3 encampments a week. Prior to the pandemic, the weekly number ranged between 40 and 60, she said. I don't believe that. We are trying to handle this cleanup compassionately and make sure every camper has a different space that's safe, warm, and COVID compliant, a spokesman said. The balance of protecting the health and safety of those living outdoors in increasingly harsh conditions, as well as the safety and well-being of residents, is both complex and challenging. We remain committed to doing the difficult and necessary work to address all aspects of this crisis. Okay, good luck to them. But see, the problem is if you allow a camp to come into existence and to sit there for literally months, sometimes years, then of course it becomes harder to clear people out. And they don't benefit by living out there in the public sphere. Certainly the park doesn't benefit. I mentioned earlier that David Perdue, one of the 2 Senate candidates, had put forward a strong ad for his race. He's the one who isn't under quarantine right now. Senator Perdue has a strong ad that talks about his successes in the Senate. And I think it's an effective campaign device and theme for the election coming up January 5th. This is clip 13. Listen.
I'm David Perdue. I approve this message. When the virus hit, I got to work for you and got $47 billion for Georgia hospitals, schools, small businesses, farmers, and communities. We accelerated investment in vaccines, PPE, and testing. Saved 1.5 million jobs. No radical socialist agenda could do that. We're going to beat this virus, reignite our economy, and create even more jobs. That's the hopeful America I believe in.
Okay, that's a strong ad. He is running against an extreme liberal named John Ossoff, a documentary filmmaker. I don't know if he'll make a film about this campaign. But the idea that David Perdue, who has been a good and effective and popular senator, should be struggling so hard for re-election is an indication of just how unsettled American politics is. I'm glad to see the market settled considerably higher, 328 points up in the Dow. They obviously like the announcement that the Secretary of the Treasury is going to be Janet Yellen, who is almost universally respected for the job she did at the Fed, where she was head of the Federal Reserve System. And again, one of the things about the Biden selection so far is they have not been perpetrators of a radical socialist agenda. We shall see. May it continue. We'll be right back on the Medved Show. With Thanksgiving coming up, there's a big new piece, and it goes on and on and on and on and on in the New York Times under the headline, "The Thanksgiving Myth Gets a Deeper Look This Year." And it's illustrated with a photograph of a buffalo in its death throes. And the buffalo has just been shot in the head. And this at the Turtle Mound Buffalo Ranch on the Fort Peck Indian Reservation in Montana. And the article says, on a frigid November morning inside a tractor barn in northeast Montana, 10 members of the Sioux and Assiniboine tribes joined in song to bless a 30-06 hunting rifle and to lift up the spirit of a buffalo they were preparing to kill. One man played a painted hand drum. Others passed around the burning sage. The hunt that followed took place on Turtle Mound Buffalo Ranch, 27,000 acres of rolling pasture on the Fort Peck Indian Reservation. Every stage of the hunt was marked by a ceremony to give thanks for a buffalo that descends from animals killed to near extinction by white settlers in the late 19th century. Now, of course, that's wrong. There have been several books published by University of Colorado Press that indicate that the buffalo were initially hunted to extinction by the Native American tribes to near extinction. And then white people came and made additional contributions. But the idea that everything was in harmony with nature and it was perfect before white people came, that's one of those lefty talking points that has no basis in reality. The mass killing was part of a government-approved effort to seize land from North American Native Americans who depended on the animal to survive. The brutality of settlers' expansion into the Great Plains and American West has been drastically underplayed in popular myths about the founding and growth of the United States. So says the New York Times. Arguably the best known of those myths is the story of the first Thanksgiving. A holiday Robert Magnan, who led the buffalo hunt at Fort Peck, does not observe. Thanksgiving is kind of like Columbus Day for Native people, he said. Why would we celebrate people who tried to destroy us? It is now widely accepted, says the New York Times, that the story of a friendship sealing repast between white colonists and Native Americans is inaccurate. Articles debunking the tale have become as reliable an annual media ritual as recipes for cornbread stuffing. But what are they basing it on? In other words, the entire story of the first Thanksgiving is told by eyewitnesses, by people who experienced it. And no, it's not exactly the way you see it. That involved 90, it involved more Indians than pilgrims. About half the pilgrims had died in their first winter. And they welcomed some 90 Wampanoag braves. They were almost all men, who came and joined them for a meal. And they pulled their resources. The Indians brought some venison that they had shot. And we definitely know they ate venison. We don't know if they ate turkey or not. But the idea that it's a myth, it actually happened. Maybe they didn't have cranberries. Probably they did. Who knows? But the idea that the pilgrims recorded this as a very good sign and a confirmation of a treaty that they had worked out with Massasoit and the Wampanoags. It's there. By the way, you'll hear the whole real story, the true story, based on diaries, based on recollections, based on eyewitnesses. You'll hear that true story on our history program that's going to be playing on Thanksgiving Day. And yes, you can go ahead and order it separately from Medved History Store at the holiday special. It's 25% off. This is pathetic. And they talk about a young woman who came alive, she says, her Native identity, when she was watching the movie Addams Family Values, a dark comedy released in 1993. In one scene, the character of Wednesday Addams was cast in as Pocahontas in a children's Thanksgiving play. And she goes off script to take violent revenge on the pilgrims. "You have taken the land which is rightfully ours," she calmly seethes. "Years from now, my people will be forced to live in mobile homes on your reservations. Your people will wear cardigans and drink highballs." Okay, first of all, Pocahontas had nothing to do with the pilgrims. I don't think Pocahontas ever met a pilgrim. Pocahontas was in Virginia. And it's true that the pilgrims initially were aiming the Mayflower. They wanted it to land in Virginia. Actually, they were planning, because that didn't work, to land in New York, the mouth of the Hudson River. Well, they got blown up to Massachusetts but they, as with almost everything else in their lives, saw that as providential. I agree with them, by the way. Indigenous studies is growing, they say, popular in academia, naturally, particularly among scholars whose work sits at the intersection of food, race, class, and gender. Hi, Alea Julia Hobart, an assistant professor of anthropology at University of Texas, said current events allow students to see more clearly the shared legacies of African Americans, many of whose enslaved ancestors were forced to work land stolen from Native Americans, whose agricultural know-how was also co-opted. The whole thing about stolen land, we did a segment, and maybe we should repeat that, Jeremy. There's a terrific piece that was done recently about the myth of stolen land. And now there is pushing back. We're going to cover tomorrow some of the work by the 1620 Project, which is an answer to the 1619 Project, which honors the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims and says, no, America was not set up to establish racism or to practice it, but to overcome it. Meanwhile, there's another holiday, not quite tradition, but an attempt to try to mix together two traditions, the tradition of the Christmas holiday, which is coming up, and the tradition of Star Wars. There is a Lego Star Wars holiday movie. And here's the review coming your way.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
In a galaxy far away, way back in 1978, the world watched in horror as the Star Wars holiday special became a legendary disaster. Well, now there's another try that works out much better. It's called the Lego Star Wars Holiday Special, with all your favorite characters turned into talking toys and available for streaming on Disney+.
'Twas the night before Life Day, in a galaxy far, far away. Coming together, heroes were, to celebrate the day.
And for reasons known only to Yoda, as in the previous holiday special, they refer to Christmas as Life Day. But slick animation allows the characters to come to life and to provide a fast-moving, occasionally funny, good time. With a TVG rating, 2.5 stars for the LEGO Star Wars Holiday Special, not a new Life Day classic, but 44 minutes of lightly likable entertainment. You really can't follow the plot. It has to do with Rey from the recent batch of Star Wars movies establishing a sort of a hole in the time-space vortex where she can travel back in time to the beginnings of Luke Skywalker, etc. And, of course, they're all Lego toys, so it's not so easy to tell them apart. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue talking about the abuse of Thanksgiving and that somehow it is more true to the spirit of Thanksgiving to go out and shoot a buffalo than to have a meal with your family. By the way, I wonder if that buffalo hunt, if they were socially distanced and wearing masks, who knows? We will also be talking about a liberal scholar who says that our political system is just flat unfair. And liberals have to get used to it. There are few, if any, pathways, he writes, to changing either the Electoral College or the structure of the Senate. And then there's a Holocaust Center in Florida that is honoring, I guess, the Thanksgiving holiday with a special exhibit, which has sparked outrage. An exhibit of what? Well, you'll be surprised. It's bizarre. But then again, that's life in the year 2020 in this greatest nation on God's green earth.